This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 16, 2007. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bocado. After spending more than 3 years in a Navy brig, Jose Padilla is found guilty in a civilian court on charges of conspiracy to fund terrorism overseas. Civil liberties groups say a new Bush administration plan to use satellite surveillance marks a serious intrusion. And we'll hear from Peru, where a massive earthquake leaves hundreds dead and thousands missing and injured. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A Miami jury has found Jose Padilla and his two co-defendants, Adam Amin Hassoun and Kifa Wael Jayusi, guilty on all counts of providing material aid to terrorism and of conspiracy to murder, kidnap, and maim people abroad. Padilla, who was a U.S. citizen, was held for 3.5 years in a military brig as an enemy combatant. When he was arrested in 2002, then-Attorney General John Ashcroft accused the Chicago native of conspiring to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb in the U.S. Although the dirty bomb charge has been widely associated with the case, no mention of it appeared in the actual indictment. The three men face life in prison at their sentencing hearing in December. The death toll from Tuesday's quintuple car bombing in Iraq has doubled since yesterday. Rising along with the death toll are fears that a new front has opened in Iraq's ongoing sectarian warfare. Hiba Dawood files this report.
Most of the sectarian fighting in Iraq has been between Sunnis and Shiite Muslims. But Tuesday's massive attack against the Yazidi sect in Kurdistan may draw Kurdish fighters into the fray. The death toll has reached 500, by far the worst massacre of Iraq war. 5 simultaneous car bomb explosions have left 375 injured. The attack occurred in the Sinjar district of Nineveh, home to a large Yazidi community since the 12th century. It's the second time that Yazidis have been targeted since the start of the war. In April, kidnappers abducted 23 Yazidi factory workers and later killed them. The Kurdish government today deployed 340 Peshmerga militia members, Kurdistan's official army, to provide assistance and protection to the people of Sinjar. The Nineveh province is not officially part of the semi-autonomous region of Iraqi Kurdistan, but the attack has led many local residents to support a measure to annex the province into Kurdistan. Residents say failure to join the relatively peaceful and secure region of Kurdistan would result in further attacks against the Yazidi minority group and possible mass displacement. This is Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
British police today arrested 10 climate change activists as they blocked access to a private airport near London. Manuel Rueda has more.
A small group of climate change protesters descended on Biggin Hill Airport this morning. Three protesters chained themselves to one of the airport's gates, while others lay across its only entrance road, linking their arms under yellow tubes. The police arrived shortly afterwards, removed the activists from their positions, and placed them under arrest. The action came in the context of larger protests at London's Heathrow Airport over the role of the aviation industry in the production of greenhouse gases. The demonstrators in today's protests say that the owners of private jets cannot escape criticism either. More protests against private and public aviation are expected this week, as thousands of activists continue to camp out near Heathrow, the world's busiest airport. Manuel Reda, FSRN, London.
Two leading environmental advocacy groups released a report today on the effects of mining near some of the country's best-known national landmarks. Maeve Conran reports from Colorado.
The Pew Campaign for Responsible Mining and the Environmental Working Group say the Grand Canyon and Yosemite are only some of the Western landmarks threatened by mining. Thousands of new mining claims for gold, uranium and other hard rock metals have been staked recently on public lands next to these and other national parks. Jane Danowitz, director of the Pew Campaign for Responsible Mining, describes the situation as a new gold rush that is being facilitated by an 1872 mining law still on the statute books.
Because this law is still on the books and because Congress hasn't changed it, virtually those who are interested in mining can go anywhere almost any time on public lands. They have very few environmental regulations to which they have to adhere. They also, unlike coal and oil and gas, which pay the federal government an 8% royalty at least at minimum to take federal resources off of federal lands, they pay virtually nothing.
Danowitz and the other authors of the report released today say they wish to spur Congress into action to reform this outdated law to enforce responsible mining and protect public lands. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maeve Conran in Colorado.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is pushing for constitutional reforms that would extend presidential terms from 6 to 7 years in office and abolish the limits on the number of times a candidate can run for re-election. Venezuela's constitution limits a president to 2 terms in office. Chavez is currently into his 2nd term. In a speech to the National Assembly last night, he also called for reforms to facilitate the nationalization of industries and to reduce the workday from 8 to 6 hours. Any and all changes made to Venezuela's constitution must be approved by the electorate in a nationwide referendum. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration signed off on a plan to incorporate satellite surveillance as a means to gather intelligence. Critics call the initiative a dangerous intrusion on civil liberties. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Surveillance satellites were put in place during the Cold War to monitor foreigners. Since then, their role in the United States has been for environmental and geological observation, for things like hurricanes, earthquakes, and volcanoes. But the Director of National Intelligence approved a larger role in the U.S. for the satellites. Images will be used to assist law enforcement and the intelligence community. Russ Kanaki, a spokesperson with the Department of Homeland Security.
These satellites provide us with the capability to be able to get some of that overhead imagery that are critically important to state and local partners in doing their job as law enforcement and first responders. And it's one more tool in a post-9/11 world for a homeland security mission.
Kanaki says terrorist and illegal border activity, such as drug and people smuggling, are some events the images will be used for. The federal government will share the information with federal, state, and local law enforcement. The satellites produce images that are in black and white and are still photographs, won't be watched in real time. But they are an expansive view of the land and will be stored and retrieved when necessary. John Pike with GlobalSecurity.org says law enforcement will now have greater access to technology that was previously forbidden.
But the bottom line is that the military has a lot of imagery capabilities that would not be otherwise available to domestic agencies.
But civil liberties groups are skeptical. Jay Stanley is a privacy expert with the American Civil Liberties Union. He says the administration has not been very forthcoming with the details of the technology.
You know, in some ways, this is a perfect example of what we've seen in the last 8 years, which is the giant spy apparatus that was built during the Cold War by this nation is not only being improved with new technologies, but it's being flipped around and turned inward upon the United States and its own citizens, and that's a very dangerous thing. And there need to be very, very scrupulous checks and balances put into place whenever you get anywhere near that kind of territory, and it's not being done.
The Department of Homeland Security says the program is subject to the Privacy Act to ensure civil liberties. It will undergo intensive oversight from its own Inspector General, the Office of National Intelligence, and Congress. Supreme Court cases have addressed aerial surveillance. In 2001, the Supreme Court ruled that police could not use infrared technology to monitor inside people's homes. Again, John Pike.
It's not immediately clear to me how you would be able to reconcile a constitutional prohibition on that sort of surveillance while permitting foreign intelligence agencies to take spy satellite photos of anything here in the United States.
The initiative has been approved by Congress. It will begin in October, the beginning of the new fiscal year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Fishermen in Chorrillos, Lima, Peru, scrambled to get their boats out of the water after an initial tsunami warning after last night's massive 7.9 earthquake in Ica, Peru, some 100 miles south of Lima. The tsunami warning has been canceled, although aftershocks as large as 5.6 continue to rattle the region. At least 450 people are dead, 1,500 injured, and more than 1,000 are still missing as rescuers struggle to reach those left behind after the 2-minute tremor. FSRN's Alfredo Cuadros and Pamela Cueva report from Lima, Peru.
More than 330 fatalities and 1,500 injuries are the result of the 7.9 earthquake in southern Peru. Ica, located 300 kilometers from Lima, is the region most affected. Around 70% of the city has been destroyed. Employee of a hospital in Cañete, Milagros Meneses.
I was with my children when it started moving. Then I saw the walls falling. My house is uninhabitable. The hospital has lent me a tent so my kids can sleep. The roads are damaged and people are sleeping in the streets. It is devastating.
At the time of the earthquake, the doctors were having a general strike, demanding better salaries. Currently, the hospitals have collapsed, and dead bodies are exposed in public, which could generate epidemic illness since temperatures are high in the region. This region has no power, and communications were interrupted. President Alan Garcia has declared every hospital in the country on red alert. Pavel Angeles, head of the Red Cross.
Right now, I am in Pisco City, which is the most affected area of southern Peru. We are working, searching, and rescuing people with the police and fire department, and transporting the victims with the members of the Red Cross and the health ministry. We worry because the mayor is not in the city, and we are organizing a civil defense committee. We are working with the community, and we are receiving the corresponding aid from the Red Cross. The people have to keep calm and patient in order to organize the humanitarian aid to help the most vulnerable, as is the mission of the Red Cross.
About 660 prisoners escaped from the Tambomora jail in Ica after two walls collapsed. The police are now saying that it has recaptured 23 prisoners. The Pan-American Road that crosses Peru from south to north is the only road that connects this area with the capital city. It is reportedly full of cracks, and some bridges have been felled.
There were many people inside the churches during the earthquake. We didn't know what to do or where to go. So many people stayed inside. There were many churches that fell, burying all the people who were inside. Now the relatives are removing debris with their hands because equipment is missing.
Reading for Pamela Cuerva with Alfredo Cuadros in Lima, Peru, I'm Eric Klein for Free Speech Radio News.
Meanwhile, in cities like Arequipa, Peru, far from the coast, people are spontaneously organizing to send aid and encouragement to the cities affected by the massive earthquake along the coast. FSRN's Tom Allen reports from the studios of community radio station Yaraví.
Nuestros hermanos y hermanas de Ica están sufriendo de hambre, frío y mucho dolor por la pérdida de sus...
All morning a string of people have been visiting the station, often deeply upset, with small bags of items to contribute and words of sympathy. Hugo Ramirez, the station manager and president of the National Network of Community Radios in Peru, explained why the people of Arequipa have a special sympathy for the victims of this disaster.
Radio Yaraví, estamos recibiendo muchísimas llamadas telefónicas de este...
Radio Yaraví is receiving many phone calls from the people of Arequipa that have family in the area, and we are establishing links there to find out what the situation is. The population has immediately responded, whether it be individually or collectively. Arequipa suffered from an earthquake in 2001. We have had many earthquakes, and we know what it is to experience an earthquake, the disaster and the deaths and pain that it causes. This is why we now are in solidarity with ICA, because we know the pain they are suffering. For this reason, from the station we are collecting help, food, money, clothes, medicine, to send to ICA.
There are also historical and political reasons for the swift public response, according to Hugo.
Generally, our governments in Latin America and Peru don't respond in the fastest possible manner. It is often the organizations that have to organize themselves to overcome our problems. This is a permanent part of our history.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tom Allen.
This week marks the one-year anniversary of the end of the 34-day Israeli military offensive against Lebanon last summer. The war was sparked by the capture of two Israeli soldiers by the Shia Muslim group Hezbollah. What followed was an invasion that cost 1,200 Lebanese lives, 116 Israeli lives, and more than $3 billion worth of damage to Lebanon's infrastructure. Hundreds of thousands of people gathered on Tuesday in South Beirut to mark the anniversary of the ceasefire. Despite the massive destruction from Israeli bombing to the Shia villages in southern Lebanon and to the southern Shia Muslim suburbs of Beirut, Hezbollah supporters still feel that they achieved a victory over Israel last summer. FSRN correspondent Jackson Allers reports from Beirut.
More than 1,100 Lebanese civilian lives were lost during the 34-day war with Israel last year. Hezbollah leader Syed Hassan Nasrallah emerged from the conflict with his popularity enhanced across the Arab world as a leader whose movement stood up to the Israeli military offensive. But 1 year after the ceasefire, Lebanon faces a litany of problems, including a $40 billion public debt, 2 months of fighting between the Lebanese army and Sunni Islamist insurgents in North Lebanon, and a paralyzing 10-month political stalemate between the pro-Western government and the Hezbollah-led opposition. 21-year-old Mohammed still supports Hezbollah, despite these problems.
The Israeli and the American governments both wanted to achieve things during this war, but none of it was really achieved. They wanted to control South Lebanon. They wanted to destroy the economic and political infrastructure of Hezbollah, but they failed to do this. Everyone in the West was against us, but we won. Look at the resignation of Israeli Army Chief Dan Halutz and the high officers in the Israeli Army, and the problems that Prime Minister Olmert is having. We won.
Israeli Army Chief Dan Halutz and Defense Minister Amir Peretz resigned earlier this year under heavy pressure from an Israeli populace that saw Israel's withdrawal last summer as a military failure. American University of Beirut professor Rami Zarek is a social analyst that works with Shia Muslim farmers in South Lebanon, the largest base of Hezbollah supporters. Zarek contends that Israel underestimated the civilian nature of Hezbollah's resistance.
Hezbollah is an intrinsic part of the local Lebanese society, of the society of the people of the south and of that of the people of the Bekaa. Hezbollah has emerged as a force that has represented the expectations and the political will of the Shia, that was the downtrodden class of Lebanon, for a very long time. And because Hezbollah has brought them what people live on, which is honor and pride, and that is the way they perceive it, and it has also brought them power in the Lebanese political apparatus, in which they were totally disempowered, then the people as a mass move within Hezbollah's circle and join Hezbollah.
At a rally this week staged in the heavily damaged South Beirut suburb of Dahiye, Hezbollah leader Syed Hassan Nasrallah marked the anniversary of the ceasefire with a promise that Israel is in for quote-unquote huge surprises if they attack Lebanon again. Despite a UN Security Council resolution and a 15,000-person UN peacekeeping force meant to stop the flow of arms to Hezbollah since the end of the war, Hezbollah has managed to replenish its arsenal with arms shipments through the porous borders of Syria. This according to a recent UN report. Hezbollah leads the political opposition in Lebanon, and pro-government supporters have often accused them of being a pawn of Syrian interests. Still, Hezbollah supporters like Hussein Zaiter from Baalbek in North Lebanon contend that even pro-government loyalists supported Hezbollah's resistance against Israel last summer.
Although there is a number of Lebanese who had problems with the resistance, those people really know, deep inside of their souls, that resistance is right.
Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
The Security and Prosperity Partnership, or SPP, is a trilateral North American initiative between the governments of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. Ahead of a summit between President Bush, Mexican President Felipe Calderon, and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper in Canada next week, FSRN's Stefan Christoph brings us a report on the impacts of the SPP on North American border controls and migration.
Ahead of next week's trilateral summit in Montebello, Quebec, between the leaders of North America, aimed at etching out the details for the Security and Prosperity Partnership, growing concern towards the Continental Initiative are being expressed throughout the continent. Analysts link the North American Partnership, the SPP, to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. While the SPP is not an official trade or security treaty, which means that the far-reaching impacts of the controversial initiative will not be decided upon in the Canadian Parliament or national political bodies in both Mexico and the U.S. In this light, critics of the SPP have charged the agreement as undemocratic. as the Security and Prosperity Partnership is focused on developing integrated North American security and border controls, critics of the SPP also fear that the initiative will target undocumented workers in both Canada and the U.S. Farah Najah is with No One Is Illegal in Montreal.
It seems to be clear that the only security Harper, Bush, and Calderon want is for themselves and corporations. Armed border agents, coordinated border surveillance technologies provided by major military suppliers, coordination of no-fly lists, the use of biometrics, particularly dealing with immigration, integration of refugee policies, expansion of temporary worker programs, the NAFTA superhighway, all go against human dignity and justice.
Indigenous communities living on the U.S.-Canadian border are voicing growing concern towards the SPP, while communities in Mexico organize to oppose economic projects being propelled by the SPP initiative. Construction of a NAFTA superhighway, to be discussed at next week's summit in Canada, will be built exclusively for trade purposes, not human traffic. Indigenous communities in Canada are under threat of dislocation due to the project. Nazila Batash is with Solidarity Across Borders in Montreal.
One example is something called the NAFTA Superhighway, which is a several hundred meter corridor including rail lines and pipelines crossing from Mexico to Canada, which is something that's already underway and that has been faced with significant resistance from different communities. For example, the Bubicon Nation, the Dene Nation, the Cree of Manitoba and the Prairies are communities that have been in an ongoing struggle against the theft of their land, the expropriation of their land, and the displacement of their communities as part of this project. This project has been one of the main projects that the SPP wishes to further.
In Mexico, the Security and Prosperity Partnership Initiative has been widely criticized as an attempt to fortify the increasingly militarized conditions not only along the U.S.-Mexico border, but on all borders in North America. Dr. Alejandro Villamar speaks from Mexico City on the Security and Prosperity Partnership.
The Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America is the continuation or the follow to NAFTA. The spirit of SPP is to obtain the resources from Canada, from Mexico, but without Mexicans. The consequences, if continue to build a border wall, will be too difficult for migrant workers. At the cost of lives for crossing through this desert, will be to increase.
Reporting from Montreal for FSRN, this is Stefan Christophe.
According to the National Milk Producers Federation, people in the U.S. are drinking more milk than they have in 20 years, this while the cost of milk keeps rising. The Bureau of Labor Statistics recently reported that the cost of milk has increased nearly 14% over the past year. For those who produce milk organically, however, this might not be the case. In some areas, regulatory changes and favorable prices led more farmers to produce organic milk and caused an oversupply. This might result in lower prices for organic food consumers. But for those who eat organics, it's not just the price that's important, but how the food is produced. The USDA has now started to crack down on milk producers who say they are organic but are really not. FSRN's Karen Miller reports.
Organic industry watchdog, the Cornucopia Institute, has been putting pressure on the USDA to go after big-name organic milk producers that the group charges are not meeting organic standards on the care and feeding of cows. One of these producers, says Cornucopia's Mark Castell, is Aurora Organic Dairy. Aurora operates several factory dairies that milk thousands of cows each day in Colorado and Texas.
If this was a dairy farmer in Vermont or Maine, New York or Wisconsin milking 50 cows, this person would have been decertified months and months ago. But small dairy farmers don't have the same kind of economic clout that these giant corporate dairy firms have or their customers like Walmart.
Castell says companies like Dean Foods, Kraft, and General Mills spend millions lobbying in Washington to make sure they don't have to really stick to the guidelines. Chris Galen from the lobby group National Milk Producers Federation.
All milk has to go through the same inspections, and it all has to be safe for human consumption. So basically, a lot of it has to do with how the product is produced, but most of what is involved with respect to the organic program. It's more of a marketing effort as opposed to anything that affects the nutrition level or the safety level of the resulting product.
Castell, who inspected Aurora's dairies as part of a group, says Aurora marketing is totally misleading to the average consumer.
If you went to their website, if you look at the beautiful pictures on the cartons of milk, they all show cows on grass. They show the family members. They show the little red barn.
But he adds life on the Aurora farm is quite different.
They're ugly. They're piles of dead animals. They're confined to small dirt feedlots and sheds. That's not organic. And that's why we've outed them.
One of the primary violations for big companies is the way they house animals in feedlots. Feedlots are a type of concentrated animal feeding space used prior to slaughter. Ed Maltrie is an organic milk farmer in Deerfield, Massachusetts.
It's a total confinement situation where the animals are probably continuously inside buildings or on concrete, and they are fed, housed, and cared for within a small fenced area or on concrete or under shade, so they don't get access to the benefits of being able to walk out into the pasture.
Maltrie also says that treating the cows better produces better milk.
There is quite a body of evidence now which has been accumulating both in Europe and in this country that shows that when cows are grazing on nutritious pasture, then the level of omega-3 in the milk rises.
Margo Hill from the National Sustainable Agricultural Information Service says it's the customer that loses out.
People, when they hear organic, they think, okay, well, yeah, the cows were out grazing and, you know, they weren't given antibiotics, they weren't given hormones, healthy, happy cows. And I think that's the perception that they're expecting. And so then when they come to find out that, you know, if they bought this brand of milk, then it probably came from a dairy farm where there was 10,000 cows and they weren't out on pasture all the time.
Hell says it causes people to lose confidence in the organic process. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Master drummer and jazz innovator Max Roach died late last night in New York. A self-taught musician, Roach is perhaps most notable for his ability to hold several rhythms at once by varying meters. One of the early defenders of hip-hop culture, Roach experimented with his nephew, Fab Five Freddy, in 1982. Max Roach passed away last night in a Manhattan hospital. He was 83 years old. And that will do it for today's edition of Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast online at www.fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tyna Gysi. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young, and our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. From KPFK in LA, I'm Maura Bogado.